Alexander through one of Stragos' agents. No sense in taking chances. "So much for those fine beds," said Jean as he carried their two trunks of remaining possessions out to the waiting carriages. They had kept only their implements of thieving, lockpicks, weapons, alchemical dyes, disguise items, plus a few hundred solari in cold metal, and a few sets of tunics and breeches to take to sea. "So much for Jerome de Ferrer's money." "So much for Durenna and Corvalur," said Locke with a tight smile. "So much for looking over our shoulders everywhere we go, because in truth we're stepping into a cage, but just for a few days." "No," said Jean thoughtfully, as he stepped up into a carriage door held open by a bodyguard. "No, the cage goes on much farther than that. It goes wherever we go." 12. Their training with Caldris, which resumed that afternoon, only grew more arduous. The sailing master walked them from end to end of the ship, drilling them in the operation of everything from the capstan to the cooking box. With the help of a pair of eyes, they unlashed the ship's boat, hoisted it over the side, and retrieved it. They pulled the gratings from the main deck cargo hatches and practiced sending barrels up and down with various arrangements of block and tackle. Everywhere they went, Caldris had them tying knots and naming obscure devices. Locke and Jean were given the stern cabin of the Red Messenger for their living quarters. At sea, Jean's compartment would be separated from Locke's by a thin wall of stiffened canvas, and Caldris' equally tiny cabin would be just across the passage. But for now they made the space into tolerably comfortable bachelor accommodations. The necessity of their enclosure seemed to impress upon them both the utter seriousness of their situation, and they redoubled their efforts, learning confusing new things with speed they had not required since they had last been under the tutelage of Father Chains. Locke found himself falling asleep with his copy of the lexicon for a pillow nearly every night. Mornings they sailed their dinghy west of the city, within the glass reefs, but with increasing confidence that only somewhat eclipsed actual skill. Afternoons, Caldris would call out items and locations on the deck of the ship and expect them to run to each place he named.
"Binnacle!"
the sailing master cried, and Locke and Jean raced together for the small wooden box just beside the ship's wheel that held a compass and several other navigational aids. No sooner had they touched it than Caldris cried,
"Taffrail!"
which was easy enough, the stern rail at the very end of the ship. Next, Caldris shouted,
"Craplines!"
Locke and Jean ran past the bemused kitten, who lounged on the sunlit quarterdeck licking her paws. They were grimacing as they ran, for the craplines were what they'd be bracing themselves against when they crawled out onto the bowsprit to relieve themselves into the sea. More commodious methods of shitting were for rich passengers on larger vessels.
"Mizzen mast!"
bellowed Caldris, and Locke and Jean both fetched up short, breathing heavily.
"Ship doesn't bloody have one," said Locke. "Just foremast and mainmast." "Oh, clever you! You've undone my subtle ruse, Master Costa! Get your bloody uniform, and we'll let you act the peacock for a few hours."
The three men worked together across the days to define a system of hand and verbal signals, with Locke and Jean making a few sensible adaptations from their existing private language.
"Privacy on a ship at sea is about as real as fucking fairy piss,"
Caldris grumbled one afternoon.
"I might not be able to give you clear-spoken instructions with God's know-who watching and listening. We'll work with lots of nudges and whispers. If you know something complicated is coming up, best thing to say is just, 'Let's see if you know your business, Caldris.'"
Locke found that the Ferrari naval uniform was a great aid when it came to conjuring an authoritative voice.
"Right! That or something like it. And if one of the sailors cops technical and wants your opinion on something you don't know... Come now, imaginary seaman, surely I don't have to spell it out for you like a child." "Right, good. Give me another one. Gods, damn you, I know this ship's lines like the back of my hand.
Locke looked down his nose at Caldris, which was only possible because his leather boots added an inch and a half to his height.
And I know what she's capable of. Trust my judgment or feel free to start swimming. Yes, a fine job, Master Custer.
The sailing master squinted at Locke and scratched his beard.
Where does Master Custer go when you do that? What exactly is it you do for a living, Leo Canto?
I do this, I suppose. I'm a professional pretender. I act.
On the stage?
Once upon a time, Jerome and I both. Now I suppose we make this ship our stage.
Indeed you do.
Caldris moved to the wheel, which was actually a pair of wheels, joined by a mechanism below the deck to allow more than one sailor to exert their strength against it in hard weather, evading a brief attack on his bare feet from the kitten.
Places!
Locke and Jean hurried to the quarterdeck to stand near him, ostensibly aloof and concentrating on their own tasks, while remaining close enough to pick up on a whisper or a prompting gesture.
Imagine us beating to windward with the breeze coming in across the larboard bow, said Caldris.
It was necessary to imagine, for in the enclosed little bay not the slightest breeze stirred.
The time has come for us to tack. Just sound off the steps. I need to know you've got them down.
Locke pictured the operation in his head. No square-rigged ship could sail straight into the wind. To move a desired direction against the breeze required sailing at something like a 45-degree angle to it, and switching over at intervals to present different sides of the bow to the wind. It was, in effect, a series of zigzags, tack after tack, arduously clawing in a desired direction. Each changeover, from larboard tack to starboard tack, or vice versa, was a delicate operation with many opportunities for disaster.
Master Caldris! He bellowed. We shall put the ship about. The wheel is yours. Very good, sir. Master de Ferrer.
Jean gave three short blasts on the whistle he wore, as Locke did around his neck.
All hands ready to put the ship about. Master Caldris, said Locke, neatness counts. Seize your wheel. Put your helm down.
Locke waited a few seconds for dramatic effect, then yelled,
Helm a lee!
Caldris mimed hauling the wheel in the direction of the ship's lee side, in this case the starboard, which would tilt the rudder in the opposite direction. Locke conjured a vivid mental picture of the sudden press of water against it, forcing the ship into a turn to larboard. They would be coming into the eye of the wind, feeling its full force. An error at this point could lock them in irons, stalling all progress, stealing power from rudder and sails alike. They would be helpless for minutes, or worse. An error like that in heavy weather could flip them, and ships were not acrobats.
Imaginary sailors! Tacks and sheets!
Jean waved his arms and hollered his instructions to the invisible deckhands.
Smartly now, you slothful dogs! Master de Ferrer, called Locke, that imaginary sailor is not minding his duty. I'll fucking kill you later, you cabbage-brained pig rapist. Seize your rope and wait for my word. Master Caldris,
Locke whirled toward the sailing master, who was nonchalantly sipping from a leather skin of pink water.
Hard over. Aye, sir.
He belched and set the skin down on the deck at his feet.
By your word, hard over.
Up mainsail, cried Locke.
Bowlines off, braces off.
Jean blew another blast on his whistle.
Yards around for the starboard tack.
In Locke's mind, the ship's bow was now tilting past the heart of the wind. The larboard bow would become their lee, and the wind would blow in across the starboard side of the ship. The yards would be rapidly rebraced for the sails to take advantage of the wind's new aspect, and Caldris would be frantically reversing his wheel's turn. The Red Messenger would need to stabilize her new course. If she was pushed too far to larboard, they might find themselves moving in the opposite of their intended direction, with the sails braced improperly to boot. They would be lucky to be merely embarrassed by such a fiasco.
"Hard over!" he yelled again. "Aye, sir!" cried Caldress. "Heard the captain fine the first time!" "Lines on! Braces on!"
Jean blew his whistle yet again.
"Haul off all, you fucking maggots!" "We're now on the starboard tack, captain," said Caldress. "Surprisingly, we didn't lose her in stays, and we'll all live to see another hour."
"Aye, no bloody thanks to this useless cur of an imaginary sailor,"
Locke mimed, grabbing a man and forcing him to the deck.
"What's your godsdamned problem, you work-shirking little orlop worm?"
"First mate de Ferrer beats me cruelly," cried Jean in a squeaky voice. "He is a monstrous bad fellow who makes me wish I'd taken priest's orders and never set foot aboard."
"Of course he does. It's what I pay him for,"
Locke mimed, hefting a blade.
"For your crimes, I swear you'll die on this very deck unless you can answer two bloody questions. First, where the hell is my non-imaginary crew? And second, why in the name of all the gods am I supposed to practice wearing this damned uniform?"
He was startled out of his act by the sound of applause from behind him. He whirled to see Merain standing just beside the entry port at the ship's rail. She'd come up the ramp in absolute silence.
"Oh, wonderful!"
She smiled at the three men on deck, stooped down and plucked up the kitten, who'd moved immediately to attack Merain's fine leather boots.
"Very convincing. But your poor invisible sailor doesn't have the answers you seek."
"Are you here to name someone who does?"
"On the morrow," she said, "the Archon orders you to take the sails of one of his private boats. He wishes to see a demonstration of your skills before you receive your final orders for sea. He and I will be your passengers. If you can keep our heads above water, he'll show you where your crew is, and why we've had you practicing with that uniform."
Chapter 7. Casting Loose. 1. There was one guard pacing the dock at the base of the lonely island. His soft yellow lamp cast rippling light across the black water as Locke threw him a rope from within the little launch. Rather than tying them up, the guard thrust his lantern down toward Locke, Jean, and Caldress, and said,
"This dock is strictly off... Oh, God, my apologies, sir."
Locke grinned, feeling the authority of the full Verari captain's uniform enfold him like nothing so much as a warm blanket. He grabbed a piling and heaved himself up onto the dock, while the guard saluted him awkwardly with his lantern hand crossed over his chest.
"Gods defend the Archon of Tal Verar," said Locke. "Carry on. It's your job to challenge strange boats at night, soldier."
While the soldier tied the launch to a piling, Locke reached down and helped Jean up. Moving gracefully in the now familiar costume, Locke then stepped around behind the dock guard, unfurled a leather crimper's hood from within his jacket, slammed it down over the soldier's head, and cinched the drawstring tight.
"God knows there's none stranger than ours that you're ever likely to see."
Jean held the soldier by his arms while the drugs inside the hood did their job. He lacked the constitution of the last man Locke had tried to knock out with such a hood, and sagged after just a few seconds of muffled struggle. When Locke and Jean tied him firmly to the piling at the far corner of the dock and stuffed a rag in his mouth, he was sleeping peacefully. Caldress clambered out of the boat, picked up the guard's lantern, and began pacing with it in his place. Locke stared up at the stone tower that was their objective. 7 stories tall, its battlements were orange-lit by alchemical navigation beacons warning ships away. Ordinarily, there would be guards up there as well, watching the waters and the dock. But the hand of Stragos was already at work. Nothing moved atop the tower.
"Come on, then,"
Locke whispered to Jean.
Let's get inside and do some recruiting.
2. It's called Windward Rock, Stragos said. He pointed at the stone tower that jutted from the little island, perhaps a single arrow flight from the line of hissing white surf that marked Talvarar's outer barrier of glass reefs. They floated at anchor in 70 feet of water, a good mile west of the Silver Marina. The warm morning sun was just rising over the city behind them, making tiers of soft light from its layers of foggy haze. True to Meryn's word, Stragos had arrived at dawn in a 30-foot launch of polished black wood, with comfortable leather seats at the stern and gold-gilded scrollwork on every surface. Locke and Jean were given the sails under Caldris' minimal supervision, while Meryn sat in the bow. Locke had wondered if she was ever comfortable anywhere else. They had sailed north, then rounded the Silver Marina and turned west, chasing the last blue shadow of the night sky on the far horizon. They rowed on for a few minutes, until Meryn whistled for everyone's attention and pointed to her left, across the starboard bow. A tall, dark structure could be seen rising above the waves in the distance. Orange lights glowed at its peak. Soon enough they had dropped anchor to regard the lonely tower. If Stragos had no praise for Locke and Jean's handling of the vessel, neither did he offer any criticism.
"Windward Rock," said Jean. "I've heard of it. Some sort of fortress."
"A prison, Master de Ferrer."
"Will we be visiting it this morning?"
"No," said Stragos. "You'll be returning and landing soon enough. For now I just wanted you to see it. And I wanted to tell you a little story. I have in my service a particularly unreliable captain, who has until now done a splendid job of concealing his shortcomings."
"Words cannot express how truly sorry I am to hear that," said Locke.
"He will betray me," said Stragos. "His plans for months have been leading up to a grand and final betrayal. He will steal something of great value from me and turn it against me for all to see."
"You should have been watching him more closely," Locke muttered.
"I have been," said Stragos, "and I am right now. The captain I speak of is you."
3. Windward Rock had only one set of doors, iron-bound, 11 feet tall, locked and guarded from the inside. A small panel in the wall beside them slid open as Locke and Jean approached, and a head silhouetted by lamplight appeared behind it. The guardswoman's voice was devoid of banter.
"Who passes?"
"An officer of Archon and Council," said Locke with ritual formality. "This man is my boatswain. These are my orders and papers."
He passed a set of documents rolled into a tight tube to the woman behind the door. She slid the panel closed over her watchhole, and Locke and Jean waited in silence for several minutes, listening to the rushing passage of surf over the nearby reefs. Two moons were just coming up, gilding the southern horizon with silver, and the stars dusted the cloudless sky like confectioner's sugar thrown against a black canvas. Finally, there was a metallic clatter, and the heavy doors swung outward on creaking hinges. The guardswoman stepped out to meet them, saluting, but not returning Locke's papers.
"My apologies for the delay, Captain Ravel. Welcome to Windward Rock."
Locke and Jean followed her into the tower's entrance hall, which was divided into two halves by a wall of black iron bars running from floor to ceiling across its breadth. On the far side of these bars, a man behind a wooden desk had control of whatever mechanism closed the gates. They clattered shut behind Locke and Jean after a few seconds. The man, like the woman, wore the Archon's blue under-ribbed black leather armor, braces, vest, and neck guard. He was clean-shaven and handsome, and he waited behind the bars as the female guard approached to pass him Locke's papers.
"Captain Orin Ravel," she said, "and boatswain, here with orders from the Archon."
The man studied Locke's papers at length before nodding and passing them back through the bars.
"Of course. Good evening, Captain Ravel. This man is your boatswain, Jerome Valora?"
Yes, Lieutenant. You are to view the prisoners in the second vault? Anyone in particular?
Just a general viewing, Lieutenant.
As you will. The man slid a key from around his neck, opened the only gate set into the wall of iron bars, and stepped out toward them, smiling. We're pleased to render any aid the Protector requires, sir.
I very much doubt that, said Locke, letting a stiletto slip into his left hand.
He reached out and gave the female guard a slash behind her right ear, across the unprotected skin between her leather neck guard and her tightly coiffed hair. She cried out, whirled, and had her blackened steel saber out of its scabbard in an instant. Jean was tackling the male guard before her blade was even out. The man uttered a surprised choking noise as Jean slammed him against the bars and gave him a sharp chop to the neck with the edge of his right hand. The leather armor robbed the blow of its lethal possibilities without dulling the shock of impact. Gasping, the guard was easily pinned from behind by Jean, who immobilized his arms and held him in a grip like iron. Locke darted backward out of the female guard's reach as she slashed with her blade. Her first attack was swift and nearly accurate. Her second was a bit slower, and Locke had no trouble avoiding it. She readied a third swing and misstepped, tripping over her own feet. Her mouth hung open in confusion.
"You fucker," she muttered. "Poison."
Locke winced as she toppled face first to the stone floor. He'd meant to catch her, but the stuff on the blade was faster than he'd expected.
"You bastard,"
coughed the lieutenant, straining uselessly in Jean's hold.
"You killed her."
"Of course I didn't kill her, you twit. Honestly, you people, pull a blade anywhere around here and everyone assumes straight away that you've killed someone." Locke stepped up before the guard and showed him the stiletto. "Stuff on the edge is called Whitfrost. You have a good hard sleep all night. Wake up around noon, at which time you'll feel like hell. Apologies. So do you want it in the neck or in the palm of your hand?"
You God's damn traitor!"
"Neck it is." Locke gave the man his own shallow cut just behind his left ear, and barely counted to eight before he was hanging in Jean's arms, limper than wet silk. Jean set the lieutenant down gently and plugged a small ring of iron keys from his belt.
"Right," said Locke, "let's pay a visit to the second vault."
4. "Ravel didn't exist until a month ago," said Stragos. "Not until I had you to build the lie around. A dozen of my most trusted men and women will swear after the fact that he was real, that they shared assignments and meals with him, that they spoke of duties and trifles in his company. My finickers have prepared orders, duty rosters, pay vouchers, and other documents, and seeded them throughout my archives. Men using the name of Ravel have rented rooms, purchased goods, ordered tailored uniforms delivered to the Sword Marina. By the time I'm dealing with the consequences of your betrayal, he'll seem real in fact and memory."
"Consequences?" asked Locke.
"Ravel is going to betray me just as Captain Bonair betrayed me when she took my basilisk out of the harbor 7 years ago and raised a red banner. It's going to happen again, twice to the same Archon. I will be ridiculed in some quarters for a time. Temporary loss for long-term gain." He winced. "Have you not considered the public reaction to what I'm arranging, Master Costa? I certainly have."
"Gods, Maxillan," said Locke, toying absently with a knot on one of the lines bracing the vessel's relatively small mainsail. "Trapped out at sea, feigning mastery in a trade for which I'm barely competent, fighting for my life with your fucking poison in my veins, I shall endeavour to keep you in my prayers for the sake of your hardship."
"Ravel is an ass, too," said the Archon. "I've had that specifically written into his back history. Now, something you should know about Tal Verar. The Priori's constables guard High Point Citadel Jail in the Castellana. The majority of the city's prisoners go there. But while Windward Rock is a much smaller affair, it's mine.
manned and provisioned only by my people." The Archon smiled. "That's where Ravel's treachery will reach the point of no return. That, Master Costa, is where you'll get your crew."
5. True to Stragos' warning, there was an additional guard to be disarmed in the first cell level beneath the entrance hall, at the foot of a wide spiral staircase of black iron. The stone tower overhead was for guards and alchemical lights. Windward Rock's true purpose was served by 3 ancient stone vaults that went down far beneath the sea into the roots of the island. The man saw them coming and took immediate alarm. No doubt Locke and Jean descending alone was a breach of procedure. Jean relieved him of his sword as he charged up the steps, kicked him in the face, and pinned him squirming on his stomach. Jean's month of exercise at Caldris' whim seemed to have left his strength more bullish than ever, and Locke almost pitied the poor fellow struggling beneath his friend. Locke reached over, gave the guard a touch of Whitfrost, and whistled jauntily. That was it for the night shift, a skeleton force with no cooks or other attendants. 1 guard at the docks, 2 in the entrance hall, 1 on the first cell level. The 2 on the roof, by Stragos' direct order, would have sipped drugged tea and fallen asleep with the pot between them. They'd be found by their morning relief with a plausible excuse for their incapacity, and another lovely layer of confusion would be thrown over the whole affair. There were no boats kept at Windward Rock itself, so even if prisoners could conceivably escape from iron-barred cells set into the weeping walls of the old vaults and win free through the barred entrance hall and lone reinforced door, they'd face a swim across a mile of open water, at least, watched with interest by many things in the depths eager for a meal. Locke and Jean ignored the iron door leading to the cells of that first level, continuing down the spiralling staircase. The air was dank, smelling of salt and unwashed bodies. Past the iron door on the second level, they found themselves in a vault divided into 4 vast cells, long and low-ceilinged, 2 on each side with a 15-foot corridor down the middle. Only 1 of these cells was actually occupied. Several dozen men lay sleeping in the pale green light of barred alchemical globes set high on the walls. The air in here was positively rank, dense with the odours of unclean bedding, urine, and stale food. Faint tendrils of mist curled around the prisoners. A few wary pairs of eyes tracked Locke and Jean as they stepped up to the cell door. Locke nodded to Jean, and the bigger man began to pound his fist against the bars of the door. The clamour was sharp, echoing intolerably from the dripping walls of the vault. Disturbed prisoners rose from their dirty pallets, swearing and hollering. "Are you men comfortable in there?" Locke shouted to be heard above the din. Jean ceased his pounding.
"We'd be lots more comfortable with a nice sweet Ferrari captain in here for us to fuck sideways," said a prisoner near the door.
"I have no patience to speak of," said Locke, pointing at the door he and Jean had come through. "If I walk back out that door, I won't be coming back."
"Piss off, then, and let us sleep,"
said a scarecrow of a man in a far corner of the cell.
"And if I won't be coming back," said Locke, "then none of you poor bastards will ever find out why Vaults 1 and 3 have prisoners in every cell, while this one is completely empty save for yourselves."
That got their attention. Locke smiled.
"That's better. My name is Orin Ravel. Until a few minutes ago, I was a captain in the navy of Tal Varar, and the reason you're here is because I selected you, every last one of you. I selected you, and then I forged the orders that got you assigned to an empty cell vault."
6.
"I chose 44 prisoners, originally," said Stragos. They stared at Windward Rock in the light of the morning sun. A boat of blue-coated soldiers was approaching it in the distance, presumably to relieve the current shift of guards. "I had the second cell vault cleared, except for them. All the orders signed Ravel are plausible, but upon scrutiny, the signs of forgery will become evident. I can use that later as a plausible excuse to arrest several clerks whose loyalties aren't straightforward enough for my taste.
Efficient, said Locke.
Yes, Stragos continued. These prisoners are all prime seamen, taken from ships that were impounded for various reasons. Some have been in custody for a few years. Many are actually former crewmen of your Red Messenger, lucky not to be executed along with their officers. Some of them might even have past experience at piracy.
Why keep prisoners at the Rock? Asked Jean. In general, I mean.
Oar fodder, answered Caldris. Handy thing to keep on hand. War breaks out, they'll be offered full pardons if they agree to work as galley rowers for the duration. The Rock tends to have a couple galleys worth most of the time. Caldris is entirely correct, said Stragos. Now, as I said, some of those men have been in there for several years, but none of them have ever had to endure conditions like those of the past month. I have had them deprived of everything from clean bedding to regular meals. The guards have been cruel, disturbing their sleeping hours with loud noises and buckets of cold water. I dare say by now that there isn't a man among them that doesn't hate Windward Rock, hate Tal Varrar, and hate me, personally.
Locke nodded slowly. And that's why you expect them to greet Ravel as their savior.
7.
You're the one responsible for shoving us into this hell, you fucking Varari Aslicker!
One of the prisoners stepped up to the bars and clutched them. The depredations of the cell vault had yet to whittle away a build frighteningly close to that of the heroic statuary of old. Locke guessed he was a recent arrival. His muscles looked carved from witchwood. His skin and hair were black enough to shrug off the pale green light, as though in disdain.
"I'm the one responsible for moving you to this vault," said Locke. "I didn't lock you up in the first place. I didn't arrange for the treatment you've been receiving."
"Treatment's a fancy fucking word for it."
"What's your name?"
"Jabril."
"Are you in charge?"
"Of what?"
Some of the man's anger seemed to ebb, transmuting to tired resignation.
"Nobody's in fucking charge behind iron bars, Captain Ravel. We piss where we sleep. We don't keep bloody muster rolls or duty shifts."
"You men are all sailors," said Locke.
"Was sailors," said Jabril.
"I know what you are. You wouldn't be here otherwise. Think about this. Thieves get let out. They go to West Citadel. They work at hard labor. They slave until they rupture or get pardoned. But even they get to see the sky. Even their cells have windows. Debtors are free to go when their debts are paid. Prisoners of war go home when the war's over. But you poor bastards, you're penned up here against need. You're cattle. If there's a war, you'll be chained to oars, and if there's no war, well..."
"There's always war," said Jabril.
7 years since the last one," said Locke. He stepped up to the bars just across from Jabril and looked him in the eyes. "Maybe 7 years again, maybe never. You really want to grow old in this vault, Jabril?"
"What's the bloody alternative, Captain?"
"Some of you came from a ship," said Locke, "impounded recently. Your captain tried to smuggle in a nest of stiletto wasps."
"The fortunate venture, aye," said Jabril. "We was promised high heaps of gold for that job."
"Fucking things killed 8 men on the voyage," said another prisoner. "We thought we'd inherit their shares."
"Turns out they was lucky," said Jabril. "They didn't have to take no share of this godsdamned place."
"The fortunate venture is riding at anchor in the Sword Marina," said Locke. "She's been rechristened the Red Messenger. Refurbished, resupplied, careened and smoked. She's been prettied up. The Archon means to take her into his service."
"Good for the bloody Archon."
I'm to command her, said Locke. She's at my disposal. I have the keys, as it were.
What the fuck do you want, then?
It's 12:30, said Locke, lowering his voice to a stage whisper that echoed dramatically to the back of the cell.
Morning relief won't arrive for more than 6 hours, and every guard on Windward Rock is currently unconscious.
The entire cell was full of wide eyes. Men heaved themselves up from their sleeping pallets and pressed closer to the bars, forming an unruly but attentive crowd.
"I am leaving Talvarar tonight," said Locke. "This is the last time I will ever wear this uniform. I am quits with the Archon and everything he stands for. I mean to take the Red Messenger, and for that I need a crew."
The mass of prisoners exploded into a riot of shoving and jabbering. Hands thrust out at Locke through the bars, and he stepped back.
"I'm a top man!" one of the prisoners yelled. "Fine top man! Take me!"
9 years at sea!" hollered another. "Do anything!"
Jean stepped up and pounded on the cell door again, bellowing,
"Quiet!"
Locke held up the ring of keys Jean had taken from the lieutenant in the entrance hall.
"I sail south on the Sea of Brass," he said. "I make for Port Prodigal. This is not subject to vote or negotiation. You sail with me, you sail under the red flag. You want off when we reach the Ghost Winds, you can have it. Until then, we're on the watch for money and plunder. No room for shirkers. The word is equal shares."
That would give them something to ponder, Locke thought. A freebooter captain more commonly took 2 to 4 shares from 10 of any plunder got at sea. Just the thought of equal shares for all would quell a great many mutinous urges.
"Equal shares," he repeated above another sudden outburst of babble. "But you make your decision here and now. Take oath to me as your captain, and I will free you immediately. I have means to get you off this rock and over to the Red Messenger. We'll have hours of darkness to clear the harbour and be well away. If you don't want to come, fine. But no courtesies in that case. You'll stay here when we're gone. Maybe the Morning Relief will be impressed with your honesty, but I doubt it. Who among you will desist?"
None of the prisoners said anything.
"Who among you will go free and join my crew?"
Locke winced at the eruption of shouts and cheers, then allowed himself a wide, genuine grin.
"All gods as your witness," he shouted, "upon your lips and upon your hearts."
"Our oath is made," said Jabril, while those around him nodded.
"Then stand upon it, or pray to die, and be damned and found wanting on the scales of the Lady of the Long Silence."
"So we stand," came a chorus of shouts.
Locke passed the ring of keys over to Jean. The prisoners watched in an ecstasy of disbelief as he found the proper key, slid it into the lock, and gave it a hard turn to the right.
8. "There is one problem," said Stragos.
"Just one?"
Locke rolled his eyes.
"There are only 40 left of the 44 I selected."
"How will that suit the needs of the ship?"
"We've got food and water for 100 days with 60, said Caldris. "And she can be handled well with half that number. Once we've got them sorted out, we'll do fine for hands at the lines."
"So you will," said Stragos. "The missing 4 are women. I had them placed in a separate cell. One of them developed a jail fever, and soon they all had it. I had no choice but to move them to shore. They're too weak to lift their arms, let alone join this expedition."
"We're for sea with not a woman aboard," said Caldris. "Will not Merain be coming with us, then?"
"I'm afraid," she said sweetly, "that my talents will be required elsewhere."
"This is mad!" cried Caldris. "We taunt the Father of Storms!"
"You can find women for your crew in Port Prodigal.
perhaps even good officers." Stragos spread his hands. "Surely you'll be fine for the duration of a single voyage down."
"Would that it were mine to so declare," said Caldrus, a haunted look in his eyes. "Master Costa, this is a poor way to start. We must have cats, a basket of cats for the Red Messenger. We need what luck we can steal. All gods as your witness, you must not fail to have cats at that ship before we put to sea."
"Nor shall I," said Locke. "Then it's settled," said Stragos. "Heed this now, Costa, concerning the depth of your deception. In case you have any misgivings, none of the men you'll be taking from Windward Rock have ever served in my navy, so they've little notion of what to expect from one of my officers, and soon enough you'll be Ravel the pirate rather than Ravel the naval captain, so you may tailor the impersonation as you see fit, and worry little over small details."
"That's good," said Locke. "I've got enough of those crammed into my head just now."
"I have one last stipulation," Stragos continued. "The men and women who serve at Windward Rock, even those who are not party to this scheme, are among my finest and most loyal. I will provide means for you to disable them without rendering permanent harm. In no way are they to be otherwise injured, not by you nor your crew, and gods help you if you leave any dead."
"Curious sentiments for a man who claims to be no stranger to risks."
"I would send them into battle at any time, Costa, and lose them willingly, but none who wear my colors honestly are to die as part of this. That much my honor compels me to grant them. You are supposed to be professionals. Consider this a test of your professionalism."
"We're not bloody murderers," said Locke. "We kill for good reason, when we kill at all."
"So much the better," said Stragos. "That is all I have to say, then. This day is yours to do with as you see fit. Tomorrow evening, just before midnight, you'll land on Windward Rock and start this business."
"We need our antidote," said Locke.
Jean and Caldrus nodded.
"Of course. You three will get your last vials just before you leave. After that, I shall expect your first return within 2 months, and a report of your progress."
9. Locke and Jean managed a ragged muster of their new crew just inside the entrance hall. Jean had to demonstrate his physical strength to several men who attempted to vent their frustrations on the sleeping guards.
"I said you touch them at your peril!"
Locke snarled for the third time.
"Let them be! If we leave them dead behind us, we'll lose all sympathy with anyone. Let them live, and Varari will be laughing about this for months to come."
"Now," he said, "move out quietly to the dockside. Take your ease, stretch your legs, have a good long look at the sea and sky. I have a boat to fetch before we can be away. For the sake of us all, keep your mouths shut."
They mostly obeyed this admonition, breaking up into little whispering groups as they moved out of the tower. Locke noticed that some of the men hung back near the door, their hands on the stones, as though afraid to step out beneath the open sky. He couldn't say he blamed them after months or years in the vault.
"That's lovely," said
Jabril, who fell into step beside Locke as they approached the dock where Caldrus paced with his lantern.
"Fucking lovely. Almost as lovely as not having to smell us all at once."
"You'll be crammed together again soon enough," said Locke.
"Aye, same, but different."
"Jabril," said Locke, raising his voice, "in time, as we come to know one another's strengths, we can hold proper votes for some of the officers we'll need. For now, I'm naming you acting mate."
"Mate of what?"
"Mate of whatever."
Locke grinned and slapped him on the back.
"I'm not in the navy anymore, remember? You'll answer to Jerome. Keep the men in order.
Take the weapons from that soldier tied to the dock, just in case we need to pull a little steel this evening. I don't expect a fight, but we should be ready.
Good evening, Captain Ravel, said Caldris. I see you fetched them out just as you planned.
Aye, said Locke. Jabril, this is Caldris, my sailing master. Caldris, Jabril is acting mate under Jerome. Listen up. Locke raised his voice without shouting, lest it echo across the water to unseen ears. I came with a boat for 6. I have a boat for 40 nearby. I need 2 men to help me row. Won't be half an hour, and then we'll be away. 2 younger prisoners stepped forward, looking eager for anything that would relieve the tedium of what they'd been through. Right, said Locke, as he stepped down into their little boat, after Caldris and the 2 sailors. Jerome, Jabril, keep order and quiet. Try to sort out those who can work right away from those who will need a few days to recover their strength. Anchored half a mile out from Windward Rock was a long launch, invisible in the moonlight until Caldris' lantern found it from about 50 yards away. Locke and Caldris worked quickly to rig the boat's small sail. Then, slowly but surely, they steered their way back toward the prison with the 2 ex-prisoners rowing the little boat beside them. Locke glanced around nervously, spotting a sail or 2 gleaming palely on the far horizons, but nothing closer. "Listen well," he said, when the launch was tied up below the dock and surrounded by his would-be crew. He was pleasantly surprised at how quickly they'd settled down to the business at hand. Of course, that made sense. They were the crews of impounded ships, not hard cases imprisoned for individual crimes. It didn't make saints of them, but it was nice to have something unforeseen working in his favour for once. "Able hands, take the oars! Don't be shy if you're less than able for the time being. I know some of you have been down there 2 damn long. Just sit down in the middle of the launch and take it easy. You can recover yourselves on the voyage out. We've plenty to eat." That lent them some cheer. Once at sea, Locke knew, the state of their rations might easily approach that of the prison slop they were leaving behind, but for a fair few days they'd have a supply of fresh meat and vegetables to look forward to. In good order, the former prisoners clambered aboard the launch. Soon the gunwales were lined with those claiming to be able-bodied, and oars were being slipped into their locks. Jabril took the bow, waving up at Locke and Caldris when all was in readiness. "Right," said Locke. "The messenger is anchored south of the Sword Marina on the seaward side, wanting nothing save her crew. 1 guard stands watch for the night, and I'll deal with him. Just follow us and go aboard once I've done that. The nets are lowered over the side and the defences are stowed." Locke took the bow of the small boat and struck what he hoped was an appropriately regal posture. Jean and Caldris took the oars, and the last 2 prisoners sat at the stern, one of them holding Caldris' lantern. "Say farewell to Windward Rock, boys," said Locke. "And bid fuck you to the Archon of Tal Verar. We're bound for sea." 10. A shadow within shadows watched the 2 boats depart. Meraine moved out of her position beside the tower and gave a small wave as the low grey shapes diminished into the south. She loosed the black silk scarf that had covered her lower face and pushed back the hood of her black jacket. She had lain in the shadows beside the tower for nearly 2 hours, waiting patiently for Costa and De Ferrer to finish their business. Her own boat was stashed beneath a rocky overhang on the east side of the island, little more than a cockle-shell of treated leather over a wood frame. Even in moonlight it was all but invisible on the water. She padded quietly into the entrance hall of the prison, finding the 2 guards much where she expected, carelessly strewn about in the grip of Whitfrost's sleep. True to the Archon's wishes, Costa and De Ferrer had prevented anyone from harming them.
"Alas for that," she whispered, kneeling over the lieutenant and running a gloved finger across his cheeks. "You're a handsome one."
She sighed, slipped a knife from its sheath within her jacket, and cut the man's throat with 1 quick slash. Moving back to avoid the growing pool of blood,
She wiped the blade on the guard's breeches and contemplated the woman lying across the entrance hall. The two atop the tower could live. It wouldn't be plausible for anyone to have climbed the stairs and gone for them. But she could do the one on the dock, the two here, and the one who was supposed to be downstairs. That would be enough, she reckoned. It wasn't that she desired Costa and De Ferrer to fail, but if they did return successful in their mission, what was to stop Stragos from assigning them to another task? His poison made tools of them indefinitely, and if they could return victorious, well, men like that were better off dead if they couldn't be put to use on behalf of the interests she served. Resolved, she set about finishing the job. The thought that for once it would be entirely painless was a comfort in her work. 11.
Captain Ravel!
The soldier was one of those hand-picked by the Archon to be in on some part of the deception. He feigned surprise as Locke appeared on the Red Messenger's deck, followed by Jean, Caldris, and the two ex-prisoners. The launch full of men was just butting up against the ship's starboard side.
"I didn't expect you back this evening, sir." "Sir, what's going on?"
"I have reached a decision," said Locke, approaching the soldier. "This ship is too fine a thing for the Archon to have, so I am relieving him of its care and taking it to sea."
"Now, hold on! Hold on, sir! That's not funny!"
"Depends on where you're standing," said Locke. He stepped up and delivered a feigned punch to the soldier's stomach. "Depends on if you're standing."
By arrangement, the man did a very credible impression of having received a devastating blow and fell backward to the deck, writhing. Locke grinned. Let his new crew whisper of that amongst themselves. The crew in question had just started to come up the boarding nets on the starboard side. Locke relieved the soldier of his sword, buckler, and knives, then joined Jean and Caldris at the rail to help the men up.
"What's to be done with the launch, Captain?"
Jabril said as he came over the side.
"It's too damn big to carry with us on this little bitch," said Locke. He jerked a thumb over his shoulder at the subdued guard. "We'll set him adrift in it. Jerome?"
"Aye, sir," said Jean.
"Get everyone up and muster all hands at the waist. Master Caldris, you know the vessel best for now. Give us lights."
Caldris fetched alchemical lamps from a locker near the wheel, and with Locke's help, he hung them about the deck until they had more than enough soft golden light to work by. Jean produced his little whistle and blew three short blasts. In moments, he had the crew herded into the middle of the ship's waist, before the mainmast. Before them all, Locke stood, stripped off his Ferrari officer's coat, and pitched it over the side. They applauded.
"Now, we must have haste without carelessness," he said. "Those of you that do not believe yourselves fit for work, hands up. No shame, lads."
Locke counted 9 hands. Most of the men who raised them were visibly aged, or far too slender for good health, and Locke nodded.
"We hold no grudge for your honesty. You'll take up your share of work once you're fit again. For now, find a spot on the main deck below or beneath the forecastle. There's mats and canvas in the main hold. You may sleep or watch the fun as you see fit. Now, can anyone among you claim to be any sort of cook?"
One of the men standing behind Jabril raised a hand.
"Good. When the anchor's up, get below and have a look at the stores. We've a brick firebox at the forecastle, plus an alchemical stone and a cauldron. We'll want a hell of a meal once we're out past the glass reefs, so show some initiative, and tap a cask of ale."
The men began cheering at that, and Jean blew his whistle to quiet them down.
"Come now!"
Locke pointed to the darkness of the Elderglass Island looming behind them. "The Sword Marina's just the other side of that island, and we're not away yet. Jerome, capstan bars and stand by to haul up anchor. Jabril, fetch rope from Caldris and help me with this fellow." Together, Locke and Jabril hoisted the incapacitated soldier to his feet. Locke tied a loose but very convincing knot around his hands with a scrap of rope provided by Caldris. Once they were gone, the man could work himself free in minutes.
"Don't kill me, Captain, please," the soldier muttered.
"I would never," said Locke. "I need you to carry a message to the Archon on my behalf. Tell him that he may kiss Orin Ravel's ass, that my commission is herewith resigned, and that the only flag his pretty ship will fly from now on is red."
Locke and Jabril hoisted the man over the side of the entry port and dropped him the 9 feet into the bottom of the launch. He yelped in, no doubt genuine, pain, and rolled over, but seemed otherwise okay.
"Use those exact words," Locke cried, and Jabril laughed. "Now, Master Caldris, we shall make for sea."
"Very good, Captain Ravel."
Caldris collared the four men nearest to him and began leading them below. Under his guidance, they would keep the anchor cable moving smoothly toward its tier on the orlop.
"Jerome," said Locke, "hands to the capstan to raise anchor."
Locke and Jabril joined all the remaining able-bodied members of the crew at the capstan, where the last of the heavy wooden bars were being slid into their apertures. Jean blew on his whistle, and the men crammed together shoulder to shoulder on the bars.
"Raise anchor! Step and on! Step and on! Push it hard! She'll be up ere long!"
Jean chanted at the top of his lungs, giving them a cadence to stamp and shove by. The men strained at the capstan, many of them weaker than they would have liked or admitted, but the mechanism began to turn, and the smell of wet cable filled the air.
"Heave and up! Heave and up! Drop the anchor, and we'll all be fucked!"
Soon enough they managed to heave the anchor up out of the water, and Jean sent a party forward to the starboard bow to secure it. Most of the men stepped away from the capstan, groaning and stretching, and Locke smiled. Even his old injuries still felt good after the exercise.
"Now," he shouted, "who among you sailed this ship when she was the Fortunate Venture? Step aside."
14 men, including Jabril, separated themselves from the others.
"And who among you were fair topmen?"
That got him 7 raised hands, good enough for the time being.
"Any of you not familiar with this ship, nonetheless comfortable up above?"
4 men stepped forward, and Locke nodded.
"Good lads. You know where you'll be, then."
He grabbed one of the non-top men by the shoulder and steered him toward the bow.
"Forward watch. Let me know if anything untoward pops up in front of us."
He grabbed another man and pointed to the mainmast.
"Get a glass from Caldris. You'll be masthead watch for now. Don't look at me like that. You won't be fucking with the rigging. Just sit still and stay awake." "Master Caldris," he bellowed, noting that the sailing master was back on deck. "Southeast by east through the reef passage called Underglass."
"Aye, sir, Underglass. I know the very one."
Caldris, of course, had plotted their course through the glass reefs in advance, and carefully instructed Locke in the orders to give until they were out of sight of Tal Verar.
"Southeast by east!"
Jean gestured at the 11 men who'd volunteered for duty up on the heights of the yardarms, where the furled sails waited, hanging in the moonlight like the thin cocoons of vast insects.
"Hands aloft to loose topsails and gallants! On the word, mind you!" "Master Caldris," shouted Locke, unable to disguise his mirth, "now we shall see if you know your business."
The Red Messenger moved south under topsails and topgallants, making fair use of the stiff breeze blowing west off the mainland. Her bow sliced smoothly through the calm, dark waters, and the deck beneath their feet heeled only the tiniest bit to starboard. It was a good start, thought Locke. A good start to a mad venture. When he had settled most of his crew in temporary positions, he stole a few minutes at the taffrail, watching the reflections of 2 moons in the gentle ripple of their wake.
"You're enjoying the hell out of yourself, Captain Ravel."
Jean stepped up to the taffrail beside him. The 2 thieves shook hands and grinned at one another.
"I suppose I am,"
Locke whispered.
I suppose this is the most lunatic thing we've ever done, and so we're entitled to bloody well enjoy ourselves.
Cruz seems to have bought the act for now. Well, they're still fresh from the vault, tired, underfed, excited. We'll see how sharp they are when they've had a few days of food and exercise. Gods, at least I didn't call anything by the wrong name.
Hard to believe we're actually doing this. I know, barely seems real yet. Captain Ravel, First Mate Valora. Hell, you've got it easy. I've got to get used to people calling me Orin. You get to stay a Jerome.
I saw little sense in making things harder for myself. I've got you to do that for me.
Careful now. I can order you whipped at the rail.
Ah, a navy captain, maybe. A pirate first mate doesn't have to stand for that.
Jean sighed. You think we'll ever see land again?
I damn well mean to, said Locke. We've got pirates to piss off, a happy return to arrange, Stragos to humble, antidotes to find, and Requin to rob blind. 2 months at sea, and I may even begin to have the faintest notion how.
They stared for a while at Tal Varrar sliding away behind them, at the aura of the golden steps and the torch glow of the Sin Spire slowly vanishing behind the darker mass of the city's southwestern crescent. Then they were passing through the navigational channel in the glass reefs, away to the Sea of Brass, away to danger and piracy, away to find war and bring it back for the Archon's convenience. 12.
Sail ahoy! Sail 2 points off the larboard bow!
The cry filtered down from above on the third morning of their voyage south. Locke sat in his cabin, regarding his blurry reflection in the dented little mirror he'd packed in his chest. Before departure, he'd used a bit of alchemy from his disguise kit to restore his hair to its natural colour, and now a fine shadow in much the same shade was appearing on his cheeks. He wasn't yet sure if he'd shave it, but with a shout from above, his concern for his beard vanished. In a moment he was out of the cabin, up the awkward steps of the dim companionway, and into the bright light of morning on the quarterdeck. A haze of high white clouds veiled the blue sky, like wisps of tobacco smoke that had drifted far from the pipes of their progenitors. They'd had the wind on their larboard beam since reaching open sea, and the Red Messenger was heeled over slightly to starboard. The constant swaying and creaking and deck slanting were utterly alien to Locke, who'd been confined to a cabin by infirmity on his last and only previous sea voyage. He flattered himself that the trained agility of a thief went some way toward feigning sea legs, but he avoided scampering around too much just in case. At least he appeared to be immune to seasickness this time out, and for that he thanked the crooked warden fervently. Many aboard had not been so lucky.
"What passes, Master Caldris?"
"Compliments of a fine morning, Captain, and the masthead watch says we got white canvas 2 points off the larboard bow."
Caldris had the wheel to himself this morning, and he drew light puffs from a cheap sheaf of cut-rate tobacco that stank like sulphur. Locke wrinkled his nose. Sighing inwardly and stepping with as much care as he could manage, Locke brought out his seeing-glass and hurried forward, up the forecastle and to the rail on the larboard bow. Yes, there it was, hull down, a minute speck of white, barely visible above the dark blue of the distant horizon. When he returned to the quarter-deck, Jabril and several other sailors were lounging around, waiting for his verdict.
"Do we give her the eyeball, Captain?"
Jabril seemed merely expectant, but the men behind him looked downright eager.
"Looking for an early taste of those equal shares, eh?"
Locke feigned deep consideration, turning toward Caldris long enough to catch the sailing master's private signal for an emphatic no. As Locke had expected, and he could give legitimate reasons without prompting.
"Can't do it, lads. You know better than that. We've not yet begun to set our own ship to rights. Little sense in taking a fight to someone else's. A quarter of us are still unfit for work, let alone battle. We've got fresh food, a clean ship, and all the time in the world. Better chances will come.
"Hold course, Master Caldris."
"Hold course, aye."
Jabril accepted this. Locke was discovering that the man had a solid core of sense and a fair knowledge of nearly every aspect of shipboard life, which made him Locke's superior in that wise. He was a fine mate, another bit of good fortune to be grateful for. The men behind Jabril now, Locke instinctively knew they needed some occupying task to help mitigate their disappointment.
"Straver," he said to the youngest, "heave the log aft. Mel, you mind the minute-glass. Report to Master Caldris. Jabril, you know how to use a recurved bow?"
"Aye, Captain. Short bow, recurved, long bow. Decent aim with any."
"I've got 10 of them in a locker down in the aft hold. Should be easy to find. Couple hundred arrows, too. Rig up some archery butts with canvas and straw. Mount them at the bow so nobody gets an unpleasant surprise in the arse. Start sharpening up the lads in groups, every day when the weather allows. Time comes to finally pay a visit to another ship, I'll want good archers in the tops."
"Fine idea, Captain."
That at least seemed to restore excitement to the sailors who were still milling near the quarterdeck. Most of them followed Jabril down a hatchway to the main deck. Their interest in the matter gave Locke a further thought.
"Master Valora!"
Jean was with Merlon, their cook, scrutinizing something at the little brick firebox abutting the forecastle. He waved an acknowledgment of Locke's shout.
"By sunset, I want to know that every man aboard knows where all the weapons lockers are. Make sure of it yourself."
Jean nodded and returned to whatever he was doing. By Locke's reckoning, the idea that Captain Ravel wanted every man to be comfortable with the ship's weapons, aside from the bows, there were hatchets, sabers, clubs, and a few polearms, would be far better for morale than the thought that he would prefer keeping them locked up or hidden.
"Well done," said Caldris quietly.
Mal watched the last few grains in the minute-glass bolted to the mainmast run out, then turned aft and shouted,
"Hold the line!"
7.5 knots,
Strever hollered a moment later.
7.5, said Caldris. "Very well. We've been making that more or less steady since we left Verar. A good run."
Locke snuck a glance at the pegs sunk into the holes on Caldris' navigational board and the compass in the binnacle, which showed them on a heading just a hair's breadth west of due south.
"A fine piece if it holds,"
muttered Caldris around his cigar.
"Puts us in the ghost winds maybe 2 weeks from today. Don't know about the captain, but getting a few days ahead of schedule makes me very bloody comfortable."
"And will it hold?"
Locke spoke as softly as he could without whispering into the sailing master's ear.
"Good question. Summer's end's an odd time on the Sea of Brass. We got storms out there somewhere. I can feel it in my bones. They're a ways off, but they're waiting."
"Oh, splendid."
"We'll make do, Captain."
Caldris briefly removed his cigar, spat something brown at the deck, and returned it to between his teeth.
"Fact is, we're doing just fine, thank the Lord of the Grasping Waters."
13.
"Ilim Jabril, get him right in the fucking heart."
Jabril stood amidships, facing a frock coat, donated from Locke's chest, nailed to a wide board and propped up against the mainmast, about 30 feet away. Both of his feet touched a crudely chalked line on the deck planks. In his right hand was a throwing knife, and in his left was a full wine bottle, by the rules of the game. The sailor who'd been shouting encouragement burped loudly and started stomping the deck. The circle of men around Jabril picked up the rhythm and began clapping and chanting, slowly at first, then faster and faster. "Don't spill a drop. Don't spill a drop. Don't spill a drop. Don't spill a drop. Don't spill a drop." Jabril flexed for the crowd, wound up, and flung the knife. It struck dead center in the coat, and up went a cheer that quickly turned to howls. Jabril had sloshed some of the wine out of the bottle.
"Dumb it!" he cried. "Wine, waster!
shouted one of the men gathered around him, with the fervour of a priest decrying the worst sort of blasphemy.
"Pay the penalty and put it where it belongs!"
"Hey, at least I hit the coat," said Jibril with a grin. "You nearly killed someone on the quarterdeck with your throw."
"Pay the price, pay the price, pay the price," chanted the crowd. Jibril put the bottle to his lips, tipped it all the way up, and began to guzzle it in one go. The chanting rose in volume and tempo as the amount of wine in the bottle sank. Jibril's neck and jaw muscles strained mightily, and he raised his free hand high into the air as he sucked the last of the dark red stuff down. The crowd applauded. Jibril pulled the bottle from his lips, lowered his head, and sprayed a mouthful of wine all over the man closest to him.
"Oh, no!" he cried. "I spilled a drop!
My turn," said the drenched sailor. "I'm going to lose on purpose and spill a drop right back, mate."
Locke and Caldris watched from the starboard rail of the quarterdeck. Caldris was taking a rare break from the wheel. Jean currently had it. They were sailing along in a calm, muggy dusk, just pleasant enough for Caldris to separate himself from the ship's precious helm by half a dozen paces.
"This was a good idea," said Locke.
"Poor bastards have been under the boot for so long, they deserve a good debauch."
Caldris was smoking a pale blue ceramic pipe, the finest and most delicate thing Locke had ever seen in his hands, and his face was lit by the soft glow of embers. At Caldris' suggestion, Locke had had large quantities of wine and beer. The Red Messenger was amply provisioned with both, and for a crew twice this size, hauled up on deck, and he'd offered a choice of indulgences to every man on board. A double ration of fresh roasted pork, courtesy of the small but well-larded pig they'd brought with them, for those who would stay sober and on watch, and a drunken party for those who wouldn't. Caldris, Jean, and Locke were sober, of course, along with four hands who'd chosen the pork.
"It's things like this that makes a ship seem like home," said Caldris. "Help you forget what a load of tedious old shit life out here can be."
"It's not so bad," said Locke, a bit wistfully.
"Aye," says the captain of the fucking ship on a night sent by the gods.
He drew smoke and blew it out over the rail.
"Well, if we can arrange a few more nights like this, it'll be bloody grand. Quiet moments are worth more than whips and manacles for discipline, mark my words."
Locke gazed out across the black waves and was startled to see a pale white-green shape, glowing like an alchemical lantern, leap up from the waves and splash back down a few seconds later. The arc of its passage left an iridescent afterimage when he blinked.
"Gods," he said, "what the hell is that?"
There was a fountain of the things now, about 100 yards from the ship. They flew silently after one another, appearing and disappearing above the surf, casting their ghostly light on black water that returned it like a mirror.
"You really are new to these waters," said Caldris. "Those are flit wraiths, Costa. South of Talvera, you see him all about. Sometimes in great schools or arches leaping over the water, over ships. They've been known to follow us about, but only after dark, mind you."
"Are they some kind of fish?"
"Nobody rightly knows," said Caldris. "Flit wraiths can't be caught. They can't be touched, as I hear it. They fly right through nets like they was ghosts. Maybe they are."
"Eerie," said Locke.
"You get used to 'em after a few years," said Caldris.
He drew smoke from his pipe, and the orange glow strengthened momentarily.
"The Sea of Brass is a damned strange place, Costa. Some say it's haunted by the Eldrin. Most say it's just plain haunted. I've seen things. St. Corella's fire, burning blue and red on the yardarms, scaring the piss out of the top watch. I sailed over seas like glass and seen a city once. Down below, not kidding, walls and towers, white stone,
plain as day, right beneath our hull, in waters that our charts put at 1,000 fathoms. Real as my nose it was, then gone.
Eh, said Locke, smiling. You're pretty good at this. You don't have to toy with me, Caldris.
I'm not toying with you one bit, Custer.
Caldris frowned, and his face took on a sinister cast in the pipelight.
I'm telling you what to expect. Flitwraiths is just the beginning. Hell, Flitwraiths is almost friendly. There's things out there even I have trouble believing, and there's places no sensible ship's master will ever go. Places that are wrong somehow. Places that wait for you.
Ah, said Locke, recalling his desperate early years in the old and rotten places of Camor, and 1,000 looming broken buildings that had seemed to wait in darkness to swallow small children. Now there I grasp your meaning.
The Ghost Wind Isles, said Caldris. Well, they're the worst of all. In fact, there's only 8 or 9 islands human beings have actually set foot on and come back to tell about it. But gods know how many more are hiding down there, under the fogs, or what the fuck's on 'em.
He paused before continuing.
You ever hear of the 3 settlements of the Ghost Winds?
I don't think so, said Locke.
Well, Caldris took another long puff on his pipe. Originally there was 3. Settlers out of Talvera touched there about 100 years ago. Founded